Close observers of the podcast will know that portions of this week's podcast have been lip-synced. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, you know, it's very difficult. We've been trying here to make lip-syncing jokes work on the radio.
For years. One could say at the entire podcast. But in fact, this has been quite an exciting week in Washington. We've had the inauguration of the president, and we also had the hearings in the Senate and the House where they finally got a chance to question Hillary Clinton about what happened in Benghazi back in September. And we also had the confirmation hearings for John Kerry.
Yes, but I think the big news, of course, is Beyonce and the fact that Brent Musburger said that she was really attractive, and that's important.
Let's just go back to that inauguration for a moment, and for just one moment, let's try to focus on some portion of it that did not involve a pop singer. I think the president also had some remarks.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth.
What I found most interesting about that speech is that, first of all, in the history of inaugural addresses, you always have the president coming on and saying that, I intend to work with Congress. Congress and I will get together, we'll solve the nation's problems. I think President Obama has had enough of that kind of rhetoric after trying, perhaps, for 4 years to work with Congress. And for whoever's fault it was, it didn't work out. He seemed almost unleashed. You know, you talk about Martin Luther King, free at last, free at last. He seemed free at last from that bipartisanship, that cooperation that he talked about the last 4 years. And, of course, the Republicans were furious.
Yeah, they immediately said, well, he wants to annihilate the Republican Party. That was the verb chosen by Speaker John Boehner.
The era of liberalism is back.
The era of big government is back as well. And all that stuff about no red states or blue states, only United States, you know.
That's Barack Obama 2004 convention.
Absolutely. Right. It was an Obama line. And that all seems to be gone, and the Republicans are noticing.
And while the Republicans were so exercised about what they heard on Monday, many progressives were saying, it's about time.
Yeah.
I mean, we had 4 years of just saying, okay, I'll be conciliatory, I'll try to do this, I'll try to work out a deal here. It looks like it's almost like a take-no-prisoners inaugural address.
Among other things, you mentioned history and these inaugural addresses. People really do tend to get down into the individual words of these addresses, and sometimes they wind up getting carved in stone, as several of them have been on the Mall in Washington. I don't know if this one ever will be, but some of the things that the president talked about, we have not heard in inauguration speeches before, especially gay rights.
Right.
I have never heard any kind of a reference to gay rights in this manner, let alone to actually embrace the history of the Stonewall Uprising in Greenwich Village in New York City, which is, to many people, a pivotal moment in the history of the gay rights movement.
Well, yeah, basically he was equating that with civil rights and equal rights for women causes of the past.
And the one issue he talked about more, I think it had something like 8 sentences in the speech, was climate change, which he had pretty much steered away from a lot of the first term after the cap-and-trade bill
and after that
went through the House and nowhere in the Senate. And he also talked about guns, not a lot, but he mentioned Newtown.
That was the only time I thought he said guns.
He said Newtown, and of course, earlier last week, he had already had a big speech on guns in particular. And he talked a lot about immigration and about it being a new day in terms of Hispanic America, Asian America, and we had several prominent Hispanics on the program right there in the inauguration, including Sonia Sotomayor swearing in the vice president.
You know, of course, we talk about the unbelievable history that everybody felt in 2009 when President Obama was first inaugurated. But this, I felt more of the diversity that we kept hearing about, certainly during the election. I felt it more in this inaugural ceremony than I did in 2009, in the sense that maybe hope was the key word in 2009, yet it just didn't seem like this was a new America. This time it did feel like a new America.
Interesting point you raise. If hope were the key word in 2009, perhaps change was the key word in 2013, because we really did see the change. We saw the change on stage. We saw it in the crowd. The crowd was not nearly as large as it was last time, maybe half as large or less. Nonetheless, it was one of the largest.
It was still 800,000,
yeah,
so a million people.
One of the largest inauguration crowds ever, and certainly as enthusiastic as the one in 2009 in its own way. And a lot of people who couldn't come then, who came this time, and a lot of people who I think were feeling a sense that if 2008 could have been dismissed historically as a kind of aberration, a fluke, if you will, the re-election of Barack Obama was in its own way politically almost more significant.
Yeah, I know. I agree completely, and I felt that way the whole time watching the ceremonies, especially when you talk about how careful and cautious that President Obama was in the first term, certainly in January 20th, 2009. I felt that caution was really thrown to the wind this time, and he was really far more aggressive, far more willing to take it to the Republicans, and I think that's why so many of the Republicans were stewing over this, and yet both sides play a role in the dysfunction of the government in the past 4 years. But it just seemed odd to hear the Republicans say, well, we knew he was a liberal. This proves he was a liberal. And we now have evidence that it's true.
Yes, he's confessed, as it were. He's actually confessed in public. All right, but we should not leave the inaugural ceremonies without noting what most Americans were noting most, Michelle's bangs.
Watching the ceremonies on television, I did notice a lot of commentary that just seemed to be so focused on clothing, on style, on the faces people would make.
But those were great coats. Those were great coats. She had a great, great coat. Her mother had a great coat on, and the daughters all had great coats, different colors. I mean, really, I mean, visually, it was high impact.
I also thought the fact that it occurred on the same day that America was honoring the birth and the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was especially significant and especially touching.
Okay, we probably said enough about the inauguration.
Oh, wait. Merle Evers' invocation was...
That was beautiful.
That was tremendous.
That
was really
moving.
Yep.
And obviously something she had written herself and something that she delivered with a great deal of force.
May the inherent dignity and inalienable rights of every woman, man, boy, and girl be honored. May all your people, especially the least of these, flourish in our blessed nation.
And we also had a poem from the poet laureate.
That was incredible.
Richard Blanco.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know you write poetry as well.
I do. Well, I was so moved by that poetry that I wrote my own poem. I spent a lot of time in this. I'd like to share it with the listener.
Oh, by all means.
An English muffin, but without butter. The second baseman for the Kansas City Royals. A Bengal tiger. A revolving door. Stephen Sondheim. The Throgs Neck Bridge. A box of thumbtacks. A Ford pickup truck. The lead singer from Menudo. 24-hour Martinizing. The Staten Island Ferry. Patty Duke and her cousin Kathy. A child who got car sick in the car on the way to seeing The Lion King. Mara Liasson's next-door neighbor. An 8-track tape, an isosceles triangle, egg drop soup, a Timex watch, McMillan and wife, and a barbershop in Nova Scotia.
I don't believe Nova Scotia is part of the United States.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean...
Ladies and gentlemen,
yes.
Ken Rudin and his poetry.
Yeah, well, it meant a lot to me, and I think it meant a lot to, perhaps, to the outgoing Secretary of State.
What difference at this point does it make?
Well, all right, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here. That's Hillary Clinton responding to a somewhat different stimulus. She is responding there to Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. Let's hear a little bit of his question.
Again, we were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But the American
people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect... The fact is, we had 4 dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
This was really, really telling because, remember, the Republicans seem to have had a love affair with Hillary Clinton the past 4 years. Now, I would make the argument that the reason they loved Hillary so much is because they hated Barack Obama so much.
They were contrasting.
Exactly. But the fact is that the love affair seems to have ended, maybe because everybody in the world is talking about 2016. But, of course, this was the testimony that we were waiting for the longest time. This is Hillary Clinton talking about the tragic events on September 11th, 2012 in Benghazi when the ambassador Chris Stevens and the 3 other Americans were killed. And the Republicans seemed to focus more on the differing answers that Susan Rice gave on Sunday talk shows, and Hillary Clinton was saying, look, what does it matter what the reason is? There were a lot of things going on at once. We lost Americans, and we are determined never to have that happen again.
Well, let's be fair to the Republicans. They had a beef back there in September because the administration, by putting Ambassador Rice out there on those five shows, was essentially saying that this was something that was kind of out of control. It was a big spontaneous demonstration. And she was just reading the talking points she had been given by the CIA, or so we're told. But it appeared as though there was an effort being made by Ambassador Rice and others in the administration to deflect any suggestion that there was an organized, perhaps al-Qaeda-inspired conspiracy and organized attack that had carried out these killings. That reflected poorly on the administration, their preparation, and their supposed defeat of al-Qaeda.
Exactly. And it also came 2 months before the election, and the last thing the Obama administration wanted to talk about, whether there was a lax security apparatus in our consulate in Benghazi. And so that was part of the Republicans' argument. It just seems like, look, it may be a legitimate argument, and I think it is a legitimate argument. At the same time, Hillary Clinton said, well, the Republicans shouldn't be cutting money for embassy security, which is also part of the thing.
Look, good point.
But the point really is that the Republicans were trying to get answers to something that they did not get back in September, and they certainly Mitt Romney didn't get that answer when he was debating Barack Obama, when that question came up, when Candy Crowley was the moderator. But Hillary Clinton's exasperation, frustration, even anger showed in her responses to the Republican senators. And you know something? The media, the political press can't help but talking about this in context of 2016, and I understand that. And at the same time, we also saw Joe Biden running, not for 2016, but running down Pennsylvania Avenue.
He was all but jumping on top of the limo.
Exactly.
He was wild in the street, in kind of a literal sense.
He looked like he was having the time of his life, and yet the contrast between the go-get-em Joe and the very serious and somber Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, talking about that is premature, but at the same time, one cannot help but draw that inference.
And if there's something that these two performances had in common, Joe Biden on Inauguration Day and Hillary Clinton a couple days later in her hearings, it was a vigorous kind of display. Both of them want to make the point that while Joe Biden may be 70 today and Hillary Clinton's in her mid-60s, they're still in the prime of life and ready and raring to go should there be some contest down the road.
And as we said earlier, the fact that the Republicans were almost itching for a fight with Hillary Clinton looked like that era of good feelings is gone probably forever.
Well, except that they do seem to be prepared to accept some of the president's new cabinet members. For example, the replacement for Hillary Clinton at State, John Kerry, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, really did not meet any kind of great hostility in meeting with his own committee in his own hearings.
No, the funniest line, of course, was John McCain saying that we're going to subject John Kerry to waterboarding.
Very funny.
There's not enough funny waterboarding jokes, but of course, look, if anybody's going to make a waterboarding joke, it's John McCain, who obviously, you know how he feels about torture. But he said, we may subject John Kerry to waterboarding to get to the truth. And, of course, everybody laughed. Yuck, yuck, yuck. This is part of the reason why Susan Rice was thrown under the bus. The Republicans insisted that John Kerry would be completely acceptable to them. And it looks like he will be completely acceptable to them. But what about Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense?
That looks like a little bit more difficult a proposition, although the Democrats, who initially had asked questions about whether or not Chuck Hagel was sufficiently supportive of Israel, seemed to have backed off those questions. Chuck Schumer, Barbara Boxer, other members of the Senate who are Democrats and also Jewish and are great supporters of Israel, initially maybe not so enthusiastic about the Chuck Hagel pick, or at least were reserving judgment. Now it seems that they're ready to get behind him, and that suggests that it'll be only a Republican rebellion, and we're going to have somebody filibuster it if it's going to be stopped.
I agree completely. I never thought the problem with Chuck Hagel, his problem with the Senate, was with Democrats. It was the Republicans who just don't like him. Part of it is issues on Israel and Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah and things like that, but mostly I think it's personal. And again, if it does come up for a vote, and I suspect it does, you'll see that the votes against him will be from the Republican Party.
Before Chuck Hagel actually takes over at Defense, of course, Leon Panetta still wants to make a couple of points before he leaves the scene. And Secretary Panetta this week made a rather historic announcement that women will now be officially allowed in combat in the U.S. Armed Forces.
Yes, and Hillary Clinton was the first example of that.
Actually, there have been any number of women who have been in one sense or another caught up in combat. They may not have been sent out into the field to engage in combat, but of course they've been caught up in it for years. And it's also been an enormous inhibition for women who are career military officers but can't be promoted above a certain grade very well because they don't have any kind of combat experience.
And when you think of women in combat, you can't help but think of Tammy Duckworth, the new Democratic congresswoman from Illinois, who lost both legs when her helicopter was shot down over Iraq. So you're absolutely right. The thought that this is the first time women are going into combat is obviously not exactly correct.
One more question about the cabinet going forward. Ken Salazar has declared that he is not going to return for a second term as the Secretary of Interior. And among the names that have been bruited for his job is Tom Udall from New Mexico, United States Senator. Can the Democrats afford to give up another Senate seat?
Well, the point is, of course, we see New Mexico moving away from that swing state aura and moving into more of a blue state.
But got a Republican governor, Susana Martinez.
Yes, and the Republican governor will name a successor, and one would think that it will be a Republican successor. But at the same time, once it goes to an election, we do find Republicans not winning, except for the governorship. And Republicans have elected a bunch of governors in New Mexico. Gary Johnson, for example, the Libertarian candidate. And, of course, Susana Martinez, who is very popular and probably favored for 2014 re-election. But for the Senate races, it may be a different story. And that's always been the risk for a president when you raid Congress to fill an administration post. We saw that, of course, with Bill Clinton naming Lloyd Benson.
Way back in 1993.
They lost that seat.
You have a good memory, Ken.
Well, it's not that long ago. I mean, and of course, Jimmy Carter, huh? When they named Walter Mondale vice president. No, look, the problem is President Obama was very lucky in 2009 when he went to the cabinet. Not only did they keep all the Democratic appointees, they even picked up John McHugh, who's the Secretary of the Army, the Republican House seat from upstate New York. They did kind of embarrass themselves with the Illinois Senate seat with Rod Blagojevich.
That didn't work out so well. So one thing we just want to touch on very briefly in this past week, one of the latest brinksmanship moments for Congress with respect to the fiscal conundrum was passed when the House of Representatives decided to approve a four-month extension of the debt limit so that now, theoretically, the Treasury Department will be able to honor all obligations and all spending commitments of the federal government until May 15th.
Well, you could also make the argument that they didn't approve anything. They basically pushed the decision down the road for 3 or 4 months. The vote was 285 to 144.
Republicans in the main voting against it.
But John Boehner, again, got what he wanted.
Looking to some of the elections that are coming up in 2013, developments this week in South Carolina, the seat of Senator Tim Scott is going to be the subject of a special election
there. Right, we're talking about the House seat that he gave up in 1st Congressional District, which is in the southeast part of South Carolina, Charleston, Hilton Head, Myrtle Beach. And, of course, this is the House seat formerly held by Mark Sanford.
The great hiker.
The great hiker, the former governor. And the primary is coming up on March 19th. But two new candidates we need to talk about that we haven't talked about, Teddy Turner IV.
Teddy the Fourth.
Who's the son of Ted Turner of CNN fame. The thought of Ted Turner's son being a Republican is pretty remarkable.
Stunning.
Another candidate, of course, is Elizabeth Colbert Bush, the sister of Stephen Colbert.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Colbert always threatens to run for office in South Carolina, of course, always with a wink. But apparently the Democrats are very serious about Elizabeth Colbert. And while this is a very solidly Republican seat, it's worth pointing out that back in 2008, when the Republican incumbent was a guy named Henry Brown, the Democratic nominee got 48% of the vote. So there are Democrats in that first congressional district. Let's just see what happens.
Staying in the South for a moment, in Virginia last week,
yikes,
on the day of inauguration, one of the members of the Virginia State Senate, an African-American, went to Washington for the Martin Luther King celebrations and for the inauguration of President Obama.
Let's point out that the Senate in Virginia is 20 Republicans, 20 Democrats.
And one of those Democrats was the African-American who went to Washington on that day. And in his absence, the Senate Republicans pushed through a redistricting plan for the state Senate.
And miraculously, it passed by a vote of 20 to 19.
Stunner.
And Democrats are livid. But not only the Democrats livid, many Republicans, including Bob McDonnell, the Republican governor.
Well, he has the chance to veto it. He doesn't have to sign it.
Well, true. And that's
if he's livid.
Well, he is livid, but there's a quandary because, of course, he also has presidential ambitions. And if he vetoes it, then a lot of the Republicans will turn on him, just like many Republicans in South Carolina have turned on Mark Sanford over the years for completely political reasons. But Bob McDonnell and people who support Bob McDonnell say that if they're going to get anything accomplished in this legislature, any kind of cooperation at all on anything, on funding, on highways and things like that, when you ram through a redistricting bill like this, it just poisons the well.
Here's another thing going on in the Old Dominion while we're in the Commonwealth of Virginia. They're also considering a bill by which they would change the way their Electoral College votes are apportioned so that instead of the statewide winner getting all 13, they would be apportioned according to the winner of each congressional district. So instead of Barack Obama, who won the state in 2012 and in 2008, instead of his getting 13 in 2012, he would have gotten 4 because Mitt Romney won in more of the congressional districts, and under this bill, each congressional district's one vote would go to the winner of that district, and the one winning the most districts would get the 2 extra votes.
Now, I know Republicans tried that gambit in Pennsylvania last year. It didn't go anywhere. But the fact that the Republicans are trying this in Virginia, heretofore a pretty solidly Republican state when it comes to presidential elections, I think it's fascinating and telling that the Republicans feel that maybe because of demographic changes, Virginia may no longer be this red state that they were accustomed to seeing in presidential years.
In a sense, though, if they were to pass this law, then they wouldn't have to care about the overall demographic change in the state, because right. as long as the people who are voting Democratic are concentrated in single districts and the white vote is more scattered out and generalized so that it can win more congressional districts, then the dynamics by which we get a Republican House nationally, even as more people vote Democratic nationally than Republican, those dynamics will then apply to the Electoral College, and you could see people who do not win the national popular vote for president getting elected president by an Electoral College driven by this kind of math.
And let's just see if this happens only in states where President Obama won. I don't see Republicans pushing this in the state of Texas, for example.
Or Kansas.
Right, exactly.
Not going to happen there. Also then moving up the Atlantic coast to New Jersey.
Happy birthday, Frank Lautenberg, the senator from New Jersey, turned 89 on Wednesday. There's some disappointing poll numbers for him that's come out from Quinnipiac this week. One, most people in New Jersey feel that his age is a big, big factor. And in that possible challenge from Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, the polls show Cory Booker winning 51-30 in a Democratic primary. Lautenberg is not happy about this at all.
Oh, I think he used the word spanking.
Well, he says, I think Cory Booker deserved a spanking for being disrespectful. When my kids act up like that, they deserve a spanking. And Lautenberg, you know,
not emphasizing the age difference by making that sort of a comparison.
And what's remarkable about that is when Frank Lautenberg was first elected in 1982, his campaign made light of Millicent Fenwick's age, because
yes.
she was a whopping 72 back then.
Yeah, well, but, you know, of course, that was his opponent at the time, and now, of course, he's wearing his 89 years with a great deal of dignity. This just seems to be the way politicians are about the question of age. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Rachel Leshinsky and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Are you lip syncing? Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.